I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and my guest today is Rupert Sheldrake.
Science as we know it, has become for many people a dogmatic belief system without them realizing it's a dogmatic belief system. They think it's an unquestionable truth. But actually, every one of these dogmas is questionable, and if one questions them, it's really liberating, both for one's personal life and, I think, for our collective life and for science itself. And I think we stand on the threshold of a new era of really free and much more interesting scientific discovery that will probably be a lot more human-friendly, holistic and cheaper than what we've got at the moment. So I'm really quite optimistic.
Dr. Rupert Sheldrake is a biologist and author of more than 80 technical papers and 10 books, including A New Science of Life. He was a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge University, where he was director of studies in cell biology and was a research fellow of the Royal Society. From 2005 to 2010, he was the director of the Perot-Warwick Project for the research on unexplained human abilities, funded from Trinity College, Cambridge University. He's currently a fellow of the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California, and a visiting professor at the Graduate Institute in Bethany, Connecticut. He is married, has two sons, and lives in London. His website is www.sheldrake.org. My interview with Dr. Sheldrake was conducted outdoors on a sunny yet windy afternoon earlier this week in Sonoma County. And may I call you Rupert?
Please.
And so, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
You are the author of a number of books on kind of an alternative approach to science. You've written books, the first one, New Science of Life in 1981, The Presence of the Past in 1988. I think one of the ones that has been quite fun is Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. Mm. So the first thing that I wanted to ask, though, was it's been 30 years since A New Science of Life has come out. And these new ideas of the morphogenetic field, which you're quite well known for. Have you had any new insights in these 30 years?
Well, several, yes. New insights into the more general nature of science, and that's one of the subjects of my new book, Science Set Free. Uh-huh. In terms of morphic resonance, applications of morphic resonance to social and cultural inheritance, to human memory, and a whole lot of new ways of testing it, which I summarize in the new edition of A New Science of Life, which is called Morphic Resonance, and which was published 2 years ago. So I've got a completely updated version of that book.
Of The New Science of Life?
Yes.
Okay.
The main thing, I think, in terms of science as a whole, is that when I wrote A New Science of Life, when it was first published in 1982, the general mainstream of biology was heading in an extremely reductionist direction, exactly the opposite direction to the way I was trying to go. They thought then that sequencing the human genome, more research in molecular biology, biotechnology, and so on, would change life as we know it, would unlock the secret of human nature, and so forth. Well, it's turned out that many of these things have been a terrible disappointment. This reductionist agenda just simply hasn't worked out as advertised.
Right.
So there was a tremendous confidence that everything would be explained in molecular terms, that morphic resonance, a more holistic approach, was unnecessary. That was the main objection I got. No one ever said this theory is wrong or the facts don't agree with it or anything like that. They just said it's unnecessary, because we'll soon have everything figured out in terms of molecular biology.
Really?
Yes, and that just simply hasn't happened. And now there's a very widespread acknowledgement that that hasn't happened. And I think there's a new spirit of openness in the sciences, which I think means that the climate's much more receptive than it used to be.
Well, that's actually very good news.
Yes.
Particularly with what we're looking at with climate change and the acidifications of the oceans. But what I wanted to do next is to go back and talk about your hypothesis of formative causation.
Yes.
And morphic resonance, memory and habituation that you speak about. Can you talk to us about what is morphic resonance?
It's a memory principle. What it does is connects things that are similar together across space and time. It's called resonance because it's about patterns of vibratory activity. Everything in nature is made up of patterns of vibratory activity: molecules, electrons, cells, organisms, solar systems, galaxies. These are all patterns of self-organizing vibratory activity. And what I'm suggesting is that similar patterns link up across time by this process I call morphic resonance. And the result of it is that each kind of thing has a collective memory. So each species of animals has a kind of collective memory through morphic resonance. So the theory makes quite a lot of predictions. One is that if you train rats to learn a new trick in San Francisco, rats all over the world will learn it quicker because the rats have learned it in San Francisco because of morphic resonance.
You have an example in, I believe it's the second book that you wrote, about this bird called a blue tit and about how it learned to pierce the caps on milk bottles across England.
Yes. That it's you call them chickadees in the United States.
Oh, okay.
And they learn to... We have doorstep milk deliveries in England every day. It still happens. I get milk delivered to my doorstep every morning, and we rinse out the bottle.
Doesn't happen these days in the United States.
No, but it still happens in London. And you rinse the bottle and put it out, and they wash them and reuse them. It's a great system. Yeah. Anyway, in the 1920s, blue tits in Southampton, in the south of England, started stealing cream from the top of milk bottles on doorsteps. They peeled off the cardboard cap and stole the cream. And this habit spread all over England in a way that was documented by amateur naturalists. And it spread at an accelerating rate. And blue tits are home-loving birds. They don't venture more than a few miles. So when it turned up independently, this form of behavior, 20 or 30 miles from a previous observation, they counted it as an independent discovery. And the rate of independent discovery accelerated in a way that led biologists at the time to think something really strange was going on. Of course, they considered the idea that it might just be copying and birds moving around. Right. But that didn't fit the facts. And so an eminent professor of biology at Oxford, Sir Alistair Hardy, came to the conclusion that something like telepathy was involved. So this fits very well with a morphic resonance explanation. It's not exactly telepathy, but it's something like it, in that it's a transfer of information from one bird to another through a kind of collective memory. So this is one of the many examples that suggest this really is happening.
And so do you hold that the so-called 100th monkey hypothesis has validity then?
I never use that myself because it's the scientific basis of it is a bit questionable. Mm-hmm. It was in Japan, scientists noticed that if they fed sweet potatoes to monkeys on the beach, the monkeys on one island started washing them, and more monkeys washed them after some had started, and then this spread to other islands, and it looked as if there was some transfer of information. But when Lyle Watson wrote about this in his book Lifetide, he deliberately exaggerated the story. He said, let us imagine, for the sake of argument, that on one day a new monkey, say the 100th monkey, learned how to do this. Then let us imagine it then spread everywhere when a critical mass had been reached. He makes it clear that he's exaggerating the known facts and making it into a story. Now, when people repeat that story, they forget all the qualifications it's become more and more it's become a kind of New Age myth, really. The basic fact that monkeys seem to learn quicker is more or less what I'm saying. But the exaggerated version of the story is easily debunked by skeptics.
Right.
And then they just say, oh, there's no validity to this at all. Uh-huh. The truth's somewhere in between. That story itself isn't very reliable, but the principle it's pointing to is, I think, the way things actually happen in the world.
You give several examples of how habit across nature is present in crystal formation.
Yes.
You gave the example of a pharmaceutical company making a particular compound and wanting to have that compound be available, but then they struggled to continue with the same recipe of making their medication. Yes. To get that particular compound to be reproducing itself.
Yes. Well, this happened. It's happened many times, actually, that when new crystals form anywhere in the world, it becomes easier for that same crystal to form elsewhere. This, I think, is an example of morphic resonance at the crystal level. Okay. This happened with an anti-AIDS drug called ritonavir, made by Abbott Laboratories. They made this drug. It worked fine, and they'd been making it for several years, when a new version of the crystal started showing up. And as soon as it had shown up, it started showing up everywhere. And they couldn't get back the original version. It was as if the fashion had changed and this new one had taken over. And this lost them hundreds of millions of dollars because the new version wasn't as soluble in water. So the previous drug formulation didn't work. They didn't dissolve in patients' stomachs. So they had to pull the drug from the market. They had a break of a year or something while they developed a new formulation. They finally had to put it out in liquid form, in capsules, and they resumed production. But the new form of the crystal was something they hadn't predicted, they hadn't expected, they couldn't get it to go away, and suddenly it was everywhere. And there's many examples in the world of synthetic chemistry, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry, where this kind of thing happens. These are called crystal polymorphs. Polymorph means many shapes, yes, many forms. And it's an area which chemists have to pay a lot of attention to, which they freely admit they don't understand what's going on there, and they don't understand how these things spread so rapidly. So I think that this is one of the areas where morphic resonance actually has practical significance.
Right, because I know that some molecules need to be left-handed and others need to be right-handed, and there is a difference in the way that those molecules act in humans.
Yes, well, that's to do with isomers, stereoisomers, but the crystal thing is somewhat different because they can all be the same handedness, the molecules, but they'll form completely different crystal forms even though the molecule itself is the same. Yes. So that's what crystal polymorphs are all about. And we're familiar with the basic principle from carbon, which can form crystals in the form of graphite or in the form of diamond.
Right.
So those are two different forms of carbon crystal.
And the diamond habit is not very common.
Not very common. And carbon graphite pencils don't turn spontaneously into diamonds because that one only forms under high pressures.
Right.
But these ones in the pharmaceutical industry are ones where under normal temperature and pressure, a new variety can come along and then rapidly spread.
Yeah. One of the first things I wanted to ask you about your general work, have you had any metaphysical insights regarding the origination of new forms and new behaviors of materials?
Well, this is really the problem of creativity. My theory is one of habit. It says that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. Morphic
yeah.
resonance is a kind of collective memory principle that leads to habits of nature building up. But, of course, you can't explain evolution just in terms of habits because something new has to happen. And clearly, creativity can happen at every level of nature. In the molecular realm, new crystals, new molecules are forming all the time. In the course of cosmic evolution, at the Big Bang, there were no crystals, there were no molecules, there were not even any atoms. So everything has actually evolved. That's what modern cosmology tells us.
Yes.
At one time, there were no zinc atoms or lead atoms or gold atoms. At one time, there were no salt crystals or sugar crystals. At one time, there was no life. There were no plants, no eyes, no wings, no feathers, no birds. All these things have come into being in time, and so has all of human culture. So there's a vast creative process unfolding in the human and non-human worlds through evolution. Now, the habit principle that works on morphic resonance explains how once new patterns have come about and been repeated, they become more habitual, and the stability of nature is really mainly a matter of habit. They don't explain how new things happen in the first place, and so this is one of the great mysteries, creativity. And there's a variety of theories of creativity. One says that everything new that happens already pre-existed in some kind of archetypal potential. It's a kind of Platonic theory of creativity.
Yeah.
I myself don't like that theory much, because what it really amounts to is a denial of creativity. It says nothing's really new. Everything's a kind of discovery or manifestation of an already present potential. So that's saying we don't need to explain creativity. Everything's given to start with, and it's only a matter of manifesting it. I prefer the idea that new things really are new, that the universe is made up as it goes along. There's a creative process at work in the whole of nature. And then how you explain that really depends on your point of view. If you're an atheist, then you can't have God or gods or creative intelligences, and you, in the end, you probably have to say it's due to chance. That's the materialist atheist theory of creativity, is that it's just chance, which amounts to saying we can't explain it, because chance is not a rational explanation. It's simply saying it just happens. Another way of looking at it is to say there's a creativity inherent in nature, which I think there is. And then you could say, well, does this come from some transcendent creative source, God, or a divine creative source? Personally, I think so. But that's not a necessary conclusion for science. The science can leave this question open. Science deals with repetitions, and morphic resonance is a theory of habit and repetition. And creativity, you can more or less take whatever theory you like and then see, you know, how things can continue by habit. That's what science can explain, not the origination, but the continuation.
One of the things that I said before we began the interview was how much I appreciated what work you have already done to help us extract ourselves out of the habits of Western science. Mm. And one of the first questions you ask is nature mechanical.
Mm. Well, the foundation of modern science in the 17th century was really based on the radical idea that nature's machine-like or mechanical. And this is what made the scientific revolution a revolution.
It kind of went hand in hand with the Industrial Revolution.
Well, it prepared the way for it, because it really treated the whole of nature as a machine. Before that, in the Middle Ages in Europe, people believed that the whole universe was a living organism with a soul, that the Earth was a living organism, Mother Earth. They believed that animals and plants have souls, they're truly alive. The word animal comes from the Latin word anima, meaning soul. So this was an organic, animistic view of nature. The Middle Ages had the orthodoxy of medieval universities in Europe was really a form of Christian animism. So it was an animistic worldview. That was what was taught in the universities. The scientific revolution in the 17th century broke with that, and it said, no, nature's not alive, the Earth isn't an organism, the universe isn't an organism, it's a machine. It has no purpose of its own, no goals or direction, no soul. It's made up of unconscious matter that just moves in accordance with mathematical laws. So that was what made science what it is. And what it did was extended this machine metaphor based on man-made machines to the whole of nature. It's very useful as a way of understanding for building machines. I mean, it works brilliantly well for machines, and most of the trends of modern technology are based on machines. I mean, iPhones, cell phones, computers, jet planes, and so forth. This approach is brilliant for making machines. It's not very good for understanding nature or minds or the nature of animals
living
or plants or living organisms.
Yeah.
So the starting point for the whole of modern science is the belief that nature is made of machinery, and machines have no purposes of their own. A car has no purpose of its own, for example. When you get in it, it'll go wherever you want to go as long as it's in working order. Mm-hmm. A horse, by contrast, has a mind of its own, and you can get on a horse and it may not want to go where you want it to go.
Right.
Even in horse races, you know, some racehorses don't want to go to the starting post, and sometimes races are held up because they have to get the horse there and the horse resists. Now, in car races, that never happens. So it's, you know, the cars just go there when the drivers are told to go. So that's the difference between machines and organisms. And the idea that nature has no purpose, for example, which is another one of the dogmas, the yes. 10 dogmas of science, follows from the idea that nature is a machine, nature is mechanical. It's not proved. This isn't proved to many places of decimals by rigorous experiments. It's simply a metaphor. And the machine metaphor on which science is based is not a testable theory. It's a metaphor. And from it follow a lot of other assumptions, like nature is purposeless, evolution has no meaning or direction. That's not proved. There's no way scientists have proved that by experiment or facts or evidence. It's simply an assumption.
It's an assumption
based on a metaphor. And that's all. And what I'm saying in my book is you don't have to believe the dogmas of science. You can question them. You can turn them into questions. Is nature mechanical? Instead of assuming nature is mechanical.
Right.
And when you look at that, you see it's only a metaphor. And it's a useful metaphor up to a point for certain aspects of nature. But it's not the truth. It's not the scientific truth about everything. But it's treated as the truth, and it's treated as the ultimate truth about everything by people who believe science is correct, factual, and true, without realizing that science is a tissue of metaphor and assumption, most of which have become deeply habitual, so habitual that people don't realize their assumptions at all.
Right, right, and they become presuppositions that really condition our way of thinking.
Basically dogmas, dogmatic assumptions, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of science is essentially a dogmatic belief system, which its believers don't realize is a belief system. Most scientists who are committed materialists think that other people have beliefs, New Agers, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, etc. They have beliefs, but scientists don't have beliefs, they just know the truth. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It is a belief system, and it's more insidious because people don't realize it's a belief system.
Right.
I mean, Christians, Jews, Hindus, etc., realize that what their belief system is a belief system, whereas most believers in science don't realize it's a belief system.
And there's a holding of inerrancy from all of the real strong believers in these systems.
Well, exactly. There's plenty of evangelical scientific fundamentalists, and they think they know the truth. I think that's what I call the science delusion, the belief that science already understands the nature of reality. My book, Science Set Free, is called The Science Delusion in Britain. It's got a different title there.
It
plays off Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion.
Yes.
But in America, my publishers felt that wouldn't work, partly because Dawkins isn't so well known here, and partly because in America...
And they wouldn't know the play on the title.
The play on the title. And in America, there's also an anti-science movement, you know, creationism, climate change denial. We don't have that in Europe. They thought the book called The Science Delusion might be mistaken as an anti-science polemic, which is not. It's pro-science. The whole point of the book is to help liberate science from these dogmatic assumptions so it can become freer, more fun, and actually achieve its true goals better. So this is very pro-science, this book, and therefore the American title, Science Set Free, expresses that, I think, rather well.
Yeah, yeah. You are a biologist, and one of the books that you've written that I very much enjoyed was Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. But we'll talk about that in a minute. I wanted to talk about the second point that you made in your book about is the total amount of matter and energy always the same, which looks, again, at a mechanical mode of the cosmos and sort of a zero sum. And along with that, I'd like to ask you about what your thoughts are about the discovery and actual coming to be a closer confirmation of the Higgs field.
Okay. Well, first, the idea of the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. It's an assumption that we're all taught in school as part of physics, you know, the law of conservation of matter
and
energy.
And that was a Newtonian principle.
Yeah, well, it was actually formulated in the 1850s in its present form. But it's a fundamental principle of science. Most people assume this has been proved many decimal places, but actually it's just an assumption. It was originally adopted on philosophical and theological grounds. You know, God made the amount of matter and energy in the universe in the beginning, and because it's God made, it can't degenerate or decrease. So in the 17th century, it was explicitly theological. So it's an assumption. But physicists in the last 30 years have invented or hypothesized vast new amounts of matter and energy, dark matter and dark energy, which are now thought to make up 96% of reality. The 4% that of regular matter and energy that we learned about at school in physics classes is a tiny minority of what's there. So do we know that dark matter and dark energy are conserved? Do we know that they can't be converted into regular matter and energy? No, we don't. We don't know anything about them. Their nature is literally obscure. So can we be confident that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same when physicists have invented something like 20 times more in the last 30 years and no one's raised an eyebrow? I don't think we can. If we look at the history of it and see it's just an assumption to start with, I think this is a completely open question, and it has huge implications for the possibility of new energy technologies. There may be ways of converting some of these other forms of energy in the universe into regular forms. There's lots of people who claim to have machines that do this, above unity or free energy devices, but they're automatically marginalized as cranks because they contravene the law of matter, conservation of matter and energy.
Yeah.
So I think it's wide open, this question. And the Higgs boson research reminds us how little science really knows about fundamental things. The Higgs boson is supposed to link all known forms of matter to a new, unknown kind of field called the Higgs field, which permeates all nature. The Higgs boson is that which links the two together. Mm-hmm. And the Higgs field is supposed to be what gives things mass. Now, it's an incredible thing that in 2012, physicists have no explanation for mass, one of the most fundamental
right.
things in physics.
Yeah.
I mean, mechanistic science is based on the idea that things have mass.
And
the
gravity.
Gravity attracts according to the amount of mass. Inertia, which is a key concept in mechanics, depends on mass. And so the nature of mass itself is unknown, and this elusive particle that may or may not exist is the best shot physics has for explaining mass in terms of a field about which we know next to nothing. So it's an important reminder how little we know. Many people feel that science has got it all figured out. That is what I call the science delusion. In fact, something as fundamental as mass is utterly mysterious. And this controversy or discovery, possible discovery of the Higgs boson, is the beginning of a new chapter in science which might eventually lead to the understanding of the nature of mass, which most of us take for granted.
And I really love all of these questions in this book because you really go into each of the presuppositions that underlie them and have kind of blinded us to the possibilities that are really available in science.
Yes.
So the next thing that I wanted to talk with you about that you did speak about a little bit in the last part of the show is nature purposeless.
Well, this is simply an assumption. Again, the dogma I'm questioning there is the dogma that nature is purposeless. And that's the underlying assumption behind neo-Darwinian evolution.
Oh,
it says
yeah.
the whole of evolution is completely blind and purposeless, an interplay of chance and necessity. Well, how do we know? It's simply an assumption. If nature is mechanical, machines have no purpose, therefore nature has no purpose, therefore evolution has no purpose. It's simply an assumption. If we look at the actual course of evolution, many people who've looked at it, including the British biologist Simon Conway Morris, who's working today at Cambridge, thinks that there are purposive trends in evolution. And certainly we as humans have purpose. I mean, our whole life is full of purpose, intentions and purposes and positive thinking and group hopes and faith and the belief in progress and so forth. Purpose is certainly there in nature, but science has to try and explain it all away as an illusion or else as something that's evolved by chance. Not very convincing. But when you look at the assumption that nature's purposeless, you see it's nothing but an assumption. It's not been proved. It's not proved to rigorously through experiment to many places, decimals. It's just a starting assumption, one that scientists take for granted. But it's not a truth. It's something that could well not be true. So what I do in my chapter on Is Nature Purposeless, as in the case of the other 10 dogmas, is look at this assumption, look at the history of it, and show how it doesn't actually correspond with the facts. It doesn't hold up scientifically. It's really an open question.
The purpose is more than just to be alive, though, too, would you say?
Well, organisms have purposes which are basically, I suppose, to do with survival and reproduction.
That's right.
And we have those, and so does every organism. They wouldn't be here unless their ancestors had had those purposes.
Right.
Whether there's a higher purpose in human life beyond simply making money and to getting buying products and stuff, that's the materialist approach when applied to economics. Whether there is or not, modern science, materialist science would say, well, there isn't. There is no higher purpose because nature is purposeless and so ultimately are we. But most people don't believe that, and I think they're right not to believe it. This is an area where scientific assumptions conflict with spiritual traditions and people's most intimate experience of their own lives and the purpose of their community and the life around them and the aspirations of humanity. These things simply don't fit with the nature is purposeless view, and science has got stuck in that dogma. We know from all of the rest of our lives that there are purposes, and so people are forced into a kind of split where they're forced to assume science is right in a certain area, but then there's whole areas science can't deal with, or they have a split mentality. I think that we can heal those splits by questioning these dogmatic assumptions of science and looking at things more realistically. And I think it would be better for science as well.
In some of your work, you've dealt with the subject-object split. Is there such thing as an independent observer?
Well, exactly. And I have a chapter in my book about scientific objectivity, the illusion of objectivity. And a lot of science is based on the pretense that scientists are far more objective than they really are. That's why they adopt this artificial style in writing, a test tube was taken, instead of saying, I took a test tube.
Yes.
This passive voice style is a convention that science is fortunately growing out of, but for decades it dominated scientific writing. And it was intended to emphasize that scientists are not like other people. They're somehow observing nature as it really is, totally objectively. Well, the more that's studied about the sociology of science and the history of science, the more we realize scientists are just like other people. They're ambitious people, very often with big egos, quite frequently, competing for funds, influence, prestige, political influence, and so forth, recognition. And subject to all sorts of fallibilities and errors. And so it's much better, really, I think, to look at scientists as they really are. I agree with the goals and aspirations of science to approach truth as much as possible and to be as objective as possible. And indeed, in my own scientific work, and I've published more than 80 scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals, you know, I believe in these standards, I stick to them and work by them. Mm-hmm. But to imagine that scientists are somehow superhuman in their ability to be objective is simply not the case. And the illusion of objectivity in science is one of the reasons why people get away with such outrageous frauds within science, because people are not prepared for this.
Right.
In a culture which denies the fact that, basically tries to deny the fact that scientists are human like others.
You know, the example of cold fusion is one of those.
May or
time.
May not be, because we're not sure, because that may have been fraudulent, it may have been a mistake, they may have made a real discovery, and it may be that everyone ganged up against them and tried to denounce them. I have an open mind on that one, actually.
Well, and that's really the whole theme of your work, is to keep the open mind.
Well, exactly. I think science is about having an open mind, not pretending that we already know the truth already. And it makes science much more fun. You mentioned at the beginning this thing about my work on dogs that know when their owners are coming home.
Yes.
This is, again, something where a lot of people have dogs that seem to know when their owners are coming home. They go and wait at a door or a window when the person's on the way back. Cats do it too, and a variety of other animals. when I got interested in this, I found that most of my scientific colleagues would simply dismiss it, saying this simply doesn't happen, it's an illusion, people just projecting anthropomorphic things onto their animals, it's just wishful thinking. When I did the experiments, the rigorous experiments, people coming home at random times in unfamiliar vehicles, we found over and over again, dogs really do know, and it seems to be a kind of telepathy. So the dogmatic denial of this possibility had really held back scientific discovery for decades.
And there was another colleague, actually, who reproduced these experiments and couldn't accept his own evidence.
That's right. Well, a skeptical colleague in Britain got exactly the same results and then tried to pretend he hadn't, because he was such a deep believer in the materialist and atheist point of view that he felt he had to deny even his own evidence to preserve his worldview. This is a terrible thing, really, that this can happen in science, but it does.
And another question I wanted to ask is about the chapter you write on our memories stored as material traces.
Well, it's usually assumed, not just by scientists, but by most people, that memories are stored in the brain as material traces.
Structures of proteins in
proteins,
cells.
Phosphorylated proteins in cell membranes, modified synapses, changes in the synaptic connections between nerve cells, and so on. Well, this again is an assumption. It's been widely assumed for a very long time. Scientists have spent more than 100 years trying to find memory traces. They've been extraordinarily unsuccessful. Over and over again, these traces have proved elusive. What they have found is that certain bits of the brain become active when memories are being laid down and when they're being retrieved. But in between, they seem to vanish. And I think that's because they're not there. I think the brain works more like a receiver, tuning into memories by morphic resonance, a resonance process across time, than like a video recorder, which stores them inside itself. So I think there's a very simple explanation for 100 years of failure after the expenditure of billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of man-hours of scientific activity. They've drawn a blank on finding where memories are and how they're stored. I don't think they're there. I don't think they're stored in the brain any more than our conversation is being stored in someone's radio.
Right.
If someone analyzed a radio on which this conversation is being heard the next day, you wouldn't find traces of our conversation in the wires and transistors. That's not how the radio works.
Right.
If it was a tape recorder or a digital recorder or something, you would find traces, but the radio doesn't have the traces. It's simply a resonating device, a tuning device that tunes into things coming from somewhere else. And I think our memories are coming from our own selves in the past. They're not stored in the brain. So that's one of the issues I discuss in my chapter, Are Memories Stored in the Brain?
Well, and to continue with that, are minds confined to brains?
Well, again, this is an assumption. The materialist assumption on which science is currently based is that minds are nothing but brains. Mental activity is nothing but brain activity. Therefore, your mind's inside your head. It's
right.
In your brain.
Yep.
And I don't think that's the case, you see. I think that as I look around me now, I can see trees blowing in the wind. And the image of the trees I'm seeing, according to modern science, is inside my brain. Light comes in from through the eyes, inverted images on the retina, impulses up the optic nerves, patterns of activity in the visual cortex and other parts of the brain. Then the brain is supposed to generate images inside itself, which I experience subjectively as being large trees, redwood trees blowing in the wind, green with sunlight on them, and so on. Well, the assumption is that's all inside my brain. But if I look in somebody's brain, if somebody opened up my skull and looked at my brain, they wouldn't see any images of redwood trees inside there at all.
No.
They'd just see nerve cells.
That's right.
And nervous tissue and gray matter and stuff. So there's no evidence the images are inside the brain. What I'm suggesting is the images are exactly where they seem to be, outside the brain. When I look at a redwood tree, the redwood tree is outside me. In fact, it's where the redwood tree is. That's where my image of it is. It's not inside my head. So it's an image in my mind, but not inside my brain.
Someone has said that we live in our mind, not our mind is within us.
Yes, that puts it, it's a bit like Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas saying the soul is not inside the body is inside the soul.
Yes. I
think we live in our minds are not inside our bodies are inside our minds. Our minds are more extensive than our bodies. They stretch out to our whole perceptual world. They include our bodies. If I feel a pain in my toe, the pain, I think, is in my toe.
Right.
I don't think it's in my head being referred to the toe.
Right.
Yet modern science tries to cram all our experience into our heads. And I think this is a complete misconception. It completely violates our most immediate experience. I experience pains in my toe, in my toes. I experience an image of the redwood tree, where the redwood tree is, not inside my head. And the assumption that it's all in the head is, again, it's just an assumption. And it flies in the face of our most immediate experience. And people are encouraged by the scientific materialist worldview to accept not their own experience, but a theory, a mere theory, which is
by
based
the
on assumptions,
of the
which has the authority of science, yes.
The elders in the scientismic church.
But which totally goes against our own experience. And insofar as people believe it, in defiance of all their most immediate experience and in defiance of the evidence, because nobody can see images in brains, this is an incredible case of credulity. It's an incredible case of almost superstition, superstitious belief on the basis of authority and tradition, rather than critical thinking, science and reason. I'm all in favor of critical thinking, science and reason, but the critical thinking has to be critical, the science has to be scientific, and the reason has to be reasonable. Whereas at the moment, it's these slogans are used to justify a dogmatic belief system which actually inhibits the spirit of inquiry.
You have just written a new book called Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discovery that we've been talking about this hour. I wanted to talk now about someone who I've never met, but I have a great deal of appreciation for. And you did three-way conversations with these two men, Ralph Abraham, but also with Terence McKenna. He was an ethnobotanist.
An ethnobotanist, an expert on the shamanic use of psychedelic herbal substances.
But you guys had wonderful conversations.
Yes, well, he was a kind of polymath as well, and a man with the most incredible verbal facility. I mean, he could talk in this poetic, entrancing way. He was half Irish and half Welsh, and I think this bardic gift he had, some people say that people kissed the Blarney Stone. Some people said of Terence, he swallowed the Blarney Stone. He was such a gifted speaker. I first met him in Occidental, California, where he lived in 1982. Exactly. And so I was in San Francisco for the first time in 1982, launching my book, A New Science of Life. And a friend said, you've got to meet this friend of mine, Terence McKenna, and he sent me up to, he got me on the Greyhound bus. He said, now get off at Santa Rosa and you'll be met there by Terence McKenna. And so I stood near the bus stand in Santa Rosa, and then after a few minutes, a battered old Cadillac with huge tail fins drew up, and the window came down, and there was this guy with dark glasses and curly hair who leant out of the window and said, Dr. Sheldrake, I presume. And that was Terence McKenna. And he took me to his home in Occidental, where Ralph Abraham happened to be visiting. And we started talking. And what we had in common at the beginning was that we'd all spent time in India. Terence had traveled there. Then he traveled through Indonesia. And I worked for a year in Malaysia and traveled in Indonesia. And so, and Ralph had spent quite a bit of time in India. So we started talking, and 48 hours later, with very little time for sleep, we were still talking. And we got on so well, had such a fantastic time talking to each other, that we met every year from then on until Terence's death in 2000. Our last trialogue was in Santa Cruz in 1998. So these three-way conversations, for the first 10 years we just did this because we liked hanging out. Then somebody who knew us said, you should do a public program on this, and we did one at the Esalen Institute. And that was recorded. And from then on, we recorded them, whether we did them in private or public. Mm-hmm. And then a few years ago, Ralph Abraham discovered this box of dust-covered cassettes in his garage. And we'd forgotten about all these trilogues that we'd recorded. And he dusted them off. And one of Terence's fans digitized them. And now this huge archive of trilogues is available for free online in streaming audio. There's a link from my website, sheldrake.org. There's a section called Trilogues. And a young man in England went through them all and made notes on each trilogue. So there's a kind of catalogue, so you can see the menu of each trilogue. And then you can hear them all online. And some of them were turned into books. One book's called Chaos, Creativity and Cosmic Consciousness. And the other book's called The Evolutionary Mind. And these two books of edited trilogues, they've been selling well for years, and a lot of people read them. And I'm very pleased to say that Terence's influence, even though he's been dead for 12 years now, still remains very strong, largely through the internet.
Yes.
When I visit my sons at university, one of them's at Cambridge, the other at Sussex in England, I find that quite a few of their friends are Terence McKenna fans and are terribly keen to meet me, largely because I bathe in his reflected glory through having done these long series of conversations with him.
Right.
But he was the most extraordinary speaker, the most inventive and fertile mind, and his imagination was quite extraordinary.
Is there one thing that you would like our listeners to retain from our talk in terms of what they can come to know about your work?
Well, maybe the theme of this book, that science as we know it, has become for many people a dogmatic belief system without them realizing it's a dogmatic belief system. They think it's an unquestionable truth. But actually, every one of these dogmas is questionable, as I show in my book. And if one questions them, it's really liberating, both for one's personal life and, I think, for our collective life and for science itself. And I think we stand on the threshold of a new era of really free and much more interesting scientific discovery that will probably be a lot more human-friendly, holistic, and cheaper than what we've got at the moment. So I'm really quite optimistic.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.